Hi, my name is Connor Dunleavy, and I am an account executive and head of digital at High Touch Investor Relations, HTIR. High Touch is proud to bring you the first episode in their podcast series titled Raising Billions. With me today are two of our colleagues, Catherine LeBou and Abby Owen. We will all be talking with Laura Kiernan today about her experience in investor relations, starting High Touch Investor Relations, and everything in between.
In each of these situations, Ms. Kiernan faced significant IR challenges that had a major impact on the valuation of the company she worked for. Through her proven IR strategies, she was able to help each of these companies improve their relative values. Most recently, Ms. Kiernan founded High Touch Investor Relations, or HTIR, an investor relations and banking firm where she serves as the CEO.
I'm Abby Owen.
And I'm Catherine LeBou. This is Raising Billions.
Thank you for sitting with us today, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
So just to begin, will you tell us a little bit about High Touch Investor Relations?
Sure. High Touch Investor Relations is a company that I founded very recently. We are a strategic advisory firm focusing on investor relations and capital raising. Mm-hmm. Our clients are generally either publicly listed companies that have some sort of either significant issue or major transformation that they need assistance in getting fair valuation for the company. The other type of client we have are generally small businesses, entrepreneurs that are listed on the OTCQB or the OTCQX.
And then what's the difference between that and the NASDAQ?
So OTCQB is the venture exchange mm-hmm. in the United States. So companies with as little, you know, wanting to raise as little as $5 million as capital can list on the OTCQB Venture Exchange. The U.S. regulatory environment right now enables companies to do that with very limited amounts of filings, and it's just an easier process than listing on the NASDAQ. Once they've gone past the OTCQB stage, they can uplist to QX if their governance standards are much higher. Maybe they're filing audited financial statements. You know, they're doing regular quarterly earnings calls, these sorts of things. And then at a certain point, they might uplist to the NASDAQ. Now, the NASDAQ is, generally speaking, I would say at least $100 million in market capitalization to get listed on the NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. Sometimes also foreign companies will list on the OTC that don't want to pay the listing fees because the listing fees at the NASDAQ and NYSE are very expensive.
And then I know that you also have a banking license and are affiliated with an investment bank. I find that to be a little bit different from many, you know, strictly IR consulting firms. Can you tell me a little bit about what differentiation that gives you and the abilities that you have, having both a banking license but also this IR background?
Yes, it's interesting because I have only very recently become licensed. I've been in investor relations for 20 years, and last summer when I was starting my business up, I met with a banker who said, "You have very similar skills to bankers, so why don't you do banking?" So I thought to myself, well, I'm going to do both. I'll be an investor relations consultant, helping already listed companies, and I will also raise capital for entrepreneurs. Mm. And they're very similar. In the United States, they're considered primary and secondary markets. So primary capital is before you go public, and you have to be licensed, kind of like a real estate agent has right. to be licensed to sell real estate. Once a company is already public, it's called the secondary markets, and that's where traditional investor relations people come into play, because you have to maintain a market in your equity once you've gone public. you need, they call it aftermarket support. So now what I do is I've essentially broadened the range of things that I can do for clients by, from the very early beginnings of their company when they need to raise capital, maybe $5 million or more dollars, to, you know, literally a $10 or $12 billion company.
So kind of all in one package here.
Well, kind of. I do have a specialty, though. I am specialized. So I've developed a couple of niches in the work that I do. One is working for founder, owner-led businesses. A lot of times these businesses are unique once they go public because the CEO, who is the visionary, the entrepreneur, they know everything that they need to know about media and entertainment or wireless technology or whatever it is. But they don't necessarily know everything about how to approach investors and connect with investors. And so that's what I specialize in. I'm the liaison between the management team and the investors, and I help companies get fair value for their stock because I understand what the company's trying to communicate, and then I also know very well all of my investors and what they need and what they want. So that's how investor relations really provides value. They're able to convey, you know, what the value drivers are to investors, and that makes a market in your stock.
I know you have a bachelor's in accounting from Ithaca College and an MBA from NYU. So after beginning your career in corporate finance and accounting, how did you move into investor relations? And why have you stayed there for the past 20 years, as you said?
Well, that's a good question. So when I first went to college, I didn't really know. I knew I wanted finance or accounting of some sort.
None of us ever do.
Yeah. and so I went into accounting thinking, well, this will be a really good foundation. So accounting is really the language of investor relations. It's an essential fundamental thing that every IRO needs to know is accounting. So that for me was a really good basis, but it was really boring. I just couldn't stand the monthly cycle of things. But it was something that I had to do to get my CPA license and sort of graduate to the next level. And then I went into finance and treasury, which was absolutely fascinating. I loved it. And while I was in treasury, I was behind the scenes on capital raising. I was at Revlon and working for Ronald Perelman, who was the first billionaire that I worked for. He loved to do deals. So I would often be working on prospectuses or deal documents, drafting language in these documents for investors, putting together pro forma financial statements. And at a certain point, I said, you know what? I don't want to be behind the deal. I want to be in front of the deal. I want to be the person that is out there selling the deal. So I understood everything that was in the documents, which allowed me to have the dialogue that was necessary. But I also really enjoyed strategy and talking about management strategy. So that is how I got into investor relations. Revlon at the time was in the middle of a massive shareholder lawsuit. It was not certain at the time whether or not they would be able to refinance their bank debt, which meant there was a very high risk of default. And so that was the perfect time for me to get into investor relations because even though it was a very high risk situation, it also presented the highest opportunity. And so that's kind of what I've done my whole career is go after these very high risk, high return opportunities. And that's also what value investors do, right? So I said, if I can make my reputation in investor relations at Revlon, it'll set me up for the rest of my career. And so while I was there, I helped refinance $2 billion worth of high yield debt, but I was absolutely confident in the management team and the chairman. And so I really enjoyed doing that. And then that's when I transitioned into investor relations.
Right. I think you touched on something important there. It seems like a big crux to a lot of these successful ventures is that trust in the management team, that management team that has a specific goal in mind that they're going to go out and attain. What did you see in the management teams for some of the other companies you worked for instance, WWE or Ubiquiti Networks that you moved on to?
WWE was really fascinating. I had the opportunity to work with and for Vince McMahon, as well as the current presidents that are there, Michelle Wilson and George Barrios.
Is Vince as cool as he looks on TV?
Vince is awesome.
Yeah.
He is so cool. It's interesting because when I first joined that company, it really kind of highlighted to me the difference between perception, investor perception, and management's perception of value. And so what I worked on during my time at WWE was really helping people understand Vince and the management team and how amazing he was just as a strategist. A lot of these CEOs are phenomenal at strategy. They don't just think about today and tomorrow. They think about 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And what do they have to be doing today to lay the foundation for the next 5 or 10 years? And so Vince was excellent at that. He was also very passionate about the business. Mm-hmm. And the thing about founder-owned and led businesses is they're typically the largest individual owner of their own company.
Right.
And there is a whole category of investors that invest in founder owner led businesses because they know that the owner's entire wealth, net worth, is essentially tied up in this investment and that they will do everything they can to ensure success.
And it's their creation, it's what they've worked on. You know, they have so much more in the game than maybe somebody who just has a full round of hired executives that are running the business.
Exactly. And at Ubiquiti, it was fascinating because, again, there was a situation where perception was very misaligned with reality. With some investors, there were some investors that were I call it part of the cult of Robert Pera, and Robert Pera is the CEO of Ubiquiti Networks, and these investors really believed in his vision, his strategy, and his exceptional talent. So I didn't really need to do any convincing of those investors. What I needed to do convincing of was all the market noise around the company that often happens to companies. You have people that don't really know the story. At Ubiquiti, for example, I had to investor by investor by investor go out and meet one-on-one and spend time with, as well as the sell-side equity analysts, to clarify the story and help people really understand what I believed was the truth about the management team.
So what made you leave the safety and comfort of a full-time investor relations officer position, taking on a huge risk to start your own business?
Well, I think that points to, again, risk-taking. So I'm a calculated risk-taker. I'm very strategic and long-term thinking, but I take calculated risks because I think that in the end, you're going to get the most return for your effort. So if I would have stayed in accounting, for example, for my whole life, I might have been an Uber CPA or even a chief financial officer, something like that. But I wouldn't have had nearly the amount of joy, I don't think, that I've had doing investor relations. In 2008, I actually started my firm for the first time. It was called L. Kiernan Consulting, and it was a transitional thing in between roles because that was the time of the financial crisis, and I really wanted to stay in the game, even though there weren't that many jobs out there. So I networked. I was able to do a few different jobs. Like, I worked for Harry Winston Diamond Corporation, which is another mining company / luxury retailer. That was the second billionaire that I worked for. The founder's name was Bob Gannicott. He was an Arctic geologist, and he actually rappelled out of a helicopter to stake land in the Northwest Territories of Canada and discovered essentially, you know, $10 billion worth of diamonds up there. So he knew, based on his geological experience, that there would be diamonds in this geography. But it's sort of like finding a needle in a haystack. And with the cash that he threw off from the diamond mine, he bought Harry Winston from the Winston brothers. And he bought Harry Winston actually for $350 million, something like that. And when he hired me, he said, the end game is I want to sell Harry Winston for $1 billion. That's my price tag. So I already knew there was an end game when he hired me. And so we worked very hard to market the brand amongst luxury investors, mainly in Europe, and equity research analysts. And after 2 years of working for Harry Winston, guess how much Harry Winston was sold for?
$1 billion.
$1 billion.
Wow. That's impressive. Yeah, little mini-me. That's impressive.
Yeah, exactly. Just like mini-me.
Right. Well, I mean, I know you are impressive, and congratulations. I know you were named the number two best IRO in technology, media, telecom, small and mid-cap by institutional investors. As, you know, a very reputable IRO, what would you say are some of the attributes of an IRO that, you know, drive recognition? What qualities differentiate maybe a good IRO from an average IRO? What's that differentiator that makes an IRO special and valuable?
That's a really good question. I'll tell you in my case what I think, you know, may have been the attributes that really helped me. The hardest part of being an IRO is managing up. So how do you tell a visionary CEO or CFO or board of directors or whoever it is that you have to tell that you think they should position their story this way and that this is where investors see value? It's very delicate. So you have to be extraordinarily diplomatic and forceful at the same time. So you have to be able to manage up well. The other thing you have to be able to do is really connect with your investors. So targeting is actually, I think, the most critical skill. So targeting the right investor for your investment, because what it does is it helps you really zero in on the right investor for your stock. It makes it much easier to market the stock to them. And it also makes it easier. They hold the stock.
Right.
Someone can buy a stock and a millisecond later sell it. Right. Well, that doesn't really do me any good because it's just constant churning of my stock. I don't have any stability. What I need are long-term holders. So I need an investor that will buy my stock and hold it, kind of like the Berkshire Hathaways
right.
of the world.
Right.
So if I can get them to buy my stock, hold it, that sort of firms up the price. And then as you get new investors into the story, it creates demand for the stock. Mm-hmm. So obviously you have to be providing value. There's an underlying, you know, you have to be creating value as a company. All of these companies did create value, but not all of them were. You know, it takes time to get recognized
right.
by the financial markets and really get fair value for your stock.
All right. It's kind of like any, you know, product. There's some that are out there, like you'll pay thousands of dollars for a Louis Vuitton bag, and I'm sure it's great quality, but is it that much better than something I could get at Walmart or Target? I don't know. But there's still a price for that, and people are going to pay for it because of the story behind it, the recognition, what that company stands for, and I guess bringing that to light in your situation is key towards driving that value.
That's right. I mean, a lot of the CEOs, especially in consumer products-oriented companies, completely understand the value of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Marketing really helps drive value. You know, so for a Louis Vuitton bag, for example, it's rare, it's expensive, aspirational. There are certain aspects of a bag like that that only a very few people can actually own one. It's the same thing with stock, that if you cultivate interest amongst the right type of investor, you will get the right investor to buy your stock. And over time, it should be recognized. And from a relative valuation standpoint, it should be highly valued.
And in terms of that, I presume you need to, you know, build these relationships with these investors, because you're not just garnering the trust of a company, but you're trying to work with these investors and making them understand why this is a good investment for them, knowing that you have their back and likewise they have yours. How do you work on cultivating those relationships and maintaining those relationships for a long period of time?
That is actually critical. So even though I've moved across sectors, I've been in media and entertainment, mining, heavy equipment, cosmetics, feminine care, disruptive hardware technology, you'd be surprised. Investors, once you develop a relationship with investors, which I started way back in 2000 when I was at Revlon, you come to an understanding between you in the conversations that you have. And it's the same with the management teams and the investors. Even though they know I'm a cheerleader for the company and maybe I'm biased, of course, I drink the Kool-Aid for all the companies that I work for, they know how to interpret what I am saying. Because of that, we have a very fruitful dialogue, and they know what they can count on, what I say. That goes a long way. That's credibility. One thing I do, which I think almost all investor relations officers do, but one thing that really does separate out, you know, the better ones from the, maybe from the average ones, are the ones that do due diligence. Mm-hmm. I do a ton of due diligence. So I can't represent a company unless I completely believe in the story. And I can't profess to know something that I don't. So if I don't know the answer, I won't say that I do. I'll tell them, I'll get back to them. But in the meantime, I'm going to do all the research I can to say, you know, I understand that tax reform is going to affect us this way because, and I've spent a couple of hours talking to the head of tax, to the chief financial officer, to the legal counsel, and so on. I've spoken to all the different parties internally and also done research externally to determine, okay, this is what it means for this company. So that when I speak to an investor about that, it's authoritative and they know they can kind of rely on it. They obviously do their own due diligence,
right,
make their own decisions, but they know at least when I speak, they can rely on what I say.
I mean, to that point, it sounds like all that due diligence obviously takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. You're going to be very thorough. How does that play into the types of clients and the amount of clients that you take in now at High Touch?
So actually, one of the reasons why we call it High Touch Investor Relations is because we're very focused. We have a very focused clientele. Right now, we are a boutique, so we focus on a small number of clients. At our current size, we're less than 10 clients, and each of those we provide exceptional service to. And I don't think that, at least at our current state, that we're going to go beyond 10 clients. And I would say about half of those are investor relations clients, and the other half are banking clients we're trying to raise capital for. But there's just so much research that you have to do for each and every deal or investor story, because you really want to be credible and you need to be able to kind of look around corners and see, you know, what are the risks that an investor is facing and be overt, you know, talking about both the risks and the opportunities. And then that way the investor can really appropriately value the stock. They can determine what value they think it should be relative to where it is today, and then that's what will drive their buying decisions.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. In terms of, clearly there's this misconception between a lot of companies and not taking on IR services because maybe they're stubborn or they just believe, you know, we know what our value is. Everybody else will kind of fall in line and figure that out on their own. What do you say to those people who maybe just can't understand why they should bring you on or why they should have any IRO in general within their company?
Well, it's interesting because I've worked with CEOs that obviously value investor relations. I've also worked with CEOs that say, well, you know, let's weigh the cost benefit here. Is it really worth it to have investor relations? What I will tell you is that statistics show, mm-hmm. like Revel Research has statistics that show that companies that do good investor relations and bad investor relations can impact evaluation as much as 25% in the positive or negative direction. So if you have a $10 billion company, you could easily be leaving a couple of billion dollars on the table for investors. Now, CAPM theory tells you that over time, the future value of the stock will be embedded in the stock price. But the reality is, that is true, and economic theory does prove that out, but perception can also have a huge impact on value and perception of the value that the company is creating. And so that's where investor relations is really critical, is helping the right constituents understand the right, you know, what the company really is.
That makes sense. So in terms of, you know, your experience as an IRO, is there anything that maybe you haven't liked as much? Is there an aspect that you find most difficult or challenging in what you're doing?
Well, going back to managing up is very difficult. Mm-hmm. I've had situations where I've walked into a room and I've said to myself, you know what? I could very easily be fired today for what I'm about to say. And I'm willing to take that risk because I think it's the right thing. And I'd rather tell the CEO, you know, what I think is going to happen than tell him what he wants to hear and find out the hard way right. that I didn't warn him.
Not just being the agreeable employee, but exactly. getting in there and making sure that, you know, that story is being told or you're doing what you need to do day in and day out to get the right job done.
That's right. And managing their expectations. So you're managing investor expectations, but you're also managing management's expectations about the reality of the marketplace. That's probably the hardest thing. The other really difficult thing is that you do develop relationships with investors. And, you know, for example, during the financial crisis, that was an extraordinarily difficult situation for me because the company that I was working for, the stock went from 80 to 10.
Ooh.
And the business went, you know, from $10 billion to $5 billion in revenue. The market capitalization dropped. So I almost feel personally responsible. You know, did I adequately warn investors about the risks? Did I adequately tell them about the whole story? Obviously, it's up to the investor to make their own investment decisions, but you do feel a sense of responsibility. And during that time, the whole market was on a massive slide. I mean,
right, of course.
Citibank went from $50 to $4. So it was, on a relative basis, it was reasonable. But if you speak to individual investors that are losing their life savings, it's challenging.
It's a lot harder to have that foresight and that bigger view when it's coming out of your wallet.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I take pride in the stories that I work on, and I'm proud of almost every single one of my companies, with the exception of one, which was during the financial crisis, was much higher valued when I left than when I came. Part of that is picking the right stories. You know, it's getting value opportunities with a great management team, but also part of it is just luck, you know?
You seem to have a lot of experience with starting businesses. You said that you did one in 2008 and you're currently getting this one off the ground. What advice would you give someone starting their own small business? What would you tell them to do?
Well, it's interesting because I've had the chance to work with so many entrepreneurs. Like I said, Ronald Perelman and Vince McMahon and Robert Pera, Bob Gannicott, along with a number of others, especially investors that run their own businesses too. And I work with small entrepreneurs that are building their businesses from a very early stage. So I've had a lot of time that I have spent with these management teams, and I've really learned a lot from them. My own experience is somewhat limited in running my own business, but I tell you, you learn very quickly doing it. I've been working behind the scenes on building this business for the last, I would say, 9 months. And, you know, it takes you on a path that you never expected. You sort of start out thinking that you're going to go in this direction and this is the vision of your company. And then the reality happens. The reality can be, I've got 10 different revenue streams. There's no way that I could be strong with 10 revenue streams. So I have to focus on 2 revenue streams. I have to focus on a very specific niche. And that is the way that I'm going to be able to succeed. For example, 2 of the biggest investing themes I've focused on. One is sustainable investments, the United Nations 17 Sustainable Development Goals. And the other is short interest.
Right. And it seems like, you know, everybody goes through trials and tribulations of starting a small business. There's no, you know, real book that lays out exactly how to do it. What has been one of the biggest struggles that you found? Maybe something that going into it you didn't think was going to be an issue, but now, you know, a year or so later, I guess 4 months since the real launch, you're saying, this has been a nightmare. This has been difficult.
I don't know if I want to admit that.
Right. Well, I mean.
No, I'm kidding. Yeah. What I would say the biggest surprise and negative surprise, I'm not really sure, but it takes a really long time to get through the contractual process. So the hardest part of starting a business like mine is getting the pipeline going. It can easily take a year to develop a pipeline because you're talking to people, cultivating relationships, pitching your business, and then they say, okay, I'll think about it. Let's meet. And you start to meet, and then you get to the point where you're starting to draft engagement letters and things like that. My lawyers go through it. Their lawyers go through it. It goes through this whole process. And then you have the investor side of it too. So once you've gotten through that process with your client, my issuer client, let's say, now I have to go out and get investors and have them go through that whole process too. So what I thought might be a 3 to 4 month cycle is actually like a 1 year cycle.
Wow.
And that has been really surprising. So you have to have enough cushion starting out to get through that, essentially that first full year with a total loss.
Right. No revenues or no positive, you know.
Yeah. You're generating losses for an entire year. And, you know, every month you're putting into it, you're saying, you know, I know this is going to be worth it. You know, how am I going to pay for this or pay for that? How am I going to pay for Connor? but you have to have the fortitude, the vision, and the confidence that it's all going to pay off. Now, once that first year passes and I have a pipe, so let's say I have, you know, my 5 retainer clients and my 5 banking clients, then presumably the closes will start and I'll be generating more revenue. And I won't even, you know, time will pass and I won't necessarily even think about, wow, we've been working on this for a year.
Right.
Because everything will just start moving more quickly. So I'm hoping that's what's happening, but that has been, I would say, the biggest surprise for me.
And it always feels like no matter what you're doing in life, that first step is always the most challenging, whether it be in school, starting your own business. Well, what step or what advice would you give to somebody who wants to start their own business and doesn't know where to start, isn't sure how to get it off the ground? What would you tell them to do first to get that first out of 1,000 steps?
Well, what I would say is rip off an idea that I stole from someone else. What do they say? Copying is... It's
like the sincerest form of flattery.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. It's like sampling music kind of thing.
Yeah. So actually last year, I remember my CEO, Robert Pera, doing an interview. Actually, he did an interview on a sports radio program. And he talked about how he founded Ubiquity. And I thought it was fascinating. I mean, I knew the story, but to hear him tell it again, I thought, you know, the light bulb really went on in my head. And the story goes something like this, which is he was working at Apple. Apple was his first job out of college. And he was very ambitious and creative. And, you know, he just wanted to do so many things. And he was obviously a very talented engineer. And Apple really wanted him to stay in a box. You know, they wanted him to design within a box and put up boundaries and, you know, don't be so ambitious. And, you know, so what he did was he took it down several notches. And in the evenings and weekends, he worked on his own business. And so this is a way for people to have a lot of extra energy and you don't feel like you're able to express yourself creatively or to the fullest at work. You can take all of that extra energy and intellect and put it towards your own thing. Create something that will give you value. So he worked evenings and weekends on creating Ubiquity. At a certain point, his vision became reality and he got off the ground. He ended up borrowing something like $50,000 and launched his business. And the rest is history, right? Now it's more than $1 billion revenue generator. $10 billion enterprise value, and he owns 80% of it. So he's generated a ton of value for himself. But I said, well, geez, how can I copy that and do what I want to do, which is, you know, I want to form my own business too, and how can I make the most money doing it? So last summer, I just started little by little, bit by bit, I worked with someone, her name is Kieran Chetri, and she really helped me from a creative standpoint, working on things like the website and how we might position high touch investor relations to clients. And the story has really evolved since that time. Like I said, we've taken twists and turns, and you know, I didn't really know that I would end up here today where I'm at, but I feel really good about where we are today. And so I would just say take all that extra energy and put it into your own thing on the side. You don't have to risk what you're doing full time. But you know what? You can have so much more joy during the day if you're, you know, putting pretzels in a box, as one of my friends, that was one of her first jobs out of college. If you're putting pretzels in a box or whatever it is that you're doing that is soul killing, it will give you so much more joy during the day to know that, you know, you can go home to building your own empire.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much for sitting with us today, Laura. I really appreciate it. If you want to learn more about Laura or High Touch Investor Relations, go check out hightouchir.com. There's a little bit more about Laura, some of the clients. You can find everything there. And we appreciate you coming in and sitting with us today.
Thank you, Connor. I really appreciate it. And Abby and Catherine as well.
All right, so I just kind of...